Hello there. Today is Thursday, December 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, strong reaction around the world over President Trump's decision to call Jerusalem the capital of Israel.
This is a long overdue step to advance the peace process and to work towards a lasting agreement.
Wildfires near Los Angeles, California, cause hundreds of thousands of evacuations. The best places to work seem to have a definite pattern about them. And an American pop star teaching her daughter early how to be respected by men. It's all on today's International Edition.
While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering.
The international community was swift to react to President Donald Trump's announcement on Wednesday that the United States will formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, a move that could reignite Israeli-Palestinian violence. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised Trump's decision.
We're profoundly grateful for the president for his courageous and just decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and to prepare for the opening of the U.S. embassy here.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, though, led the chorus of global voices Wednesday urging calm and restraint.
From day one, as Secretary General of the United Nations, I have consistently spoken out against any unilateral measures that would jeopardize the prospect of peace for Israelis. Is a final status issue that must be resolved through direct negotiations between the two parties on the basis of the relevant Security Council and General Assembly resolutions, taking into account the legitimate concerns of both the Palestinian and the Israeli sides.
And Palestinian top negotiator Saeb Erekat blasted the decision as well.
This step is prejudging, dictating, closing doors for negotiations, and I think President Trump tonight disqualified the United States of America to play any role in any peace process.
Leaders and analysts have raised the alarm in recent days that such a move could be seen as a major provocation to the Palestinians and could trigger another uprising. Joining us now to discuss more is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. What's your take on this?
I think this is part of Trump violating the norms of the presidency. And if you like Trump already, you're going to probably like what he did today. For 22 years, presidents have refused to take this step, even when on the campaign trail, just as Trump did, they promised to do it. Trump finally did it.
He says that there's still a path to peace, but it would appear that he's definitely taking a side, or the U.S. is taking a side. Do you think peace is possible under these circumstances, and what does this do to that peace process?
Well, one of the reasons that prior presidents have never taken this step, even though it is politically popular with large numbers of American Jews, with America's ally Israel, and with an increasing number of evangelical Christians, is because, one, it would make us look prejudiced against the Palestinians. Two, and most importantly, a third intifada might be the result. As you might know, both intifadas, which is the Palestinian uprisings in the streets of the West Bank and Gaza, happened because of an event, a trigger. In the second intifada, it was the visit by Prime Minister Sharon to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And if a simple visit can do that, a moving of an embassy could also be the thing that starts it. So The danger of a third intifada erupting with America as the cause has always given American policymakers hesitation and prevented them from taking this step.
Would you say that this would also put the U.S. in the position that it's no longer a neutral negotiator?
Well, I don't think many people outside America or the right wing of Israel think that America is a neutral negotiator between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We are on Israel's side. We have been Israel's strongest ally for decades. So this will hurt us somewhat, but as Trump put it in his speech, for 20 years, we haven't taken this step, and peace process certainly hasn't been going well. What's the downside in doing this? How could it get worse, I think, is what he's saying.
And do you think that that's a possibility, that it could actually make progress?
I don't think it's likely that this act will contribute to peace. But I don't think there was much hope for peace anyway, that with the ongoing growth of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and the disastrous embargo of the Gaza and the division in the Palestinian leadership, there really wasn't near-term prospects for peace anyway. So I think this is likely to make it worse, but it was always already pretty bad. I also think we should be open to the idea that all the experts are wrong. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that all the experts like me were telling people that there was no way Trump could win. And he did. He broke all the rules on the campaign trail. He did things that would have killed any other previous candidate. He had scandals. He didn't release his tax returns. He engaged in personal attacks that would have made any previous presidential candidate ashamed. And he won. So it is not impossible that this bizarre move, this seemingly obsequious treatment toward the right wing of Israeli politics, will work. It's certainly not impossible.
Speaking of those settlements, Israel's continuing to build them. Under the Obama administration, they were condemning those actions and urging Israel not to continue as long as this was disputed territory. Would this give Israel carte blanche to just build away?
I think Israel already had carte blanche to build anyway. You know, Obama said some things. There were these momentary setbacks for the settler movement. But the settlements grew every year of Obama's presidency, just as they grew every year of Bush's, just as they grew every year of Clinton's. So the settlement growth, there seems to be an illusion in America that what we have in the Israel-Palestine issue is a frozen status quo. We don't. We are continually seeing changes in facts on the ground. Israel gets more and more land, more and more settlements, more and more people every year. And I don't think today's announcement is going to change that. It might give the Israeli right wing further boldness, but they were already very bold. And I would also point out one other thing. If you look at the international surveys on America's approval, how many citizens around the world trust America, there are only two countries where our image improved with the election of Donald Trump. One of them was Russia, the other was Israel. Obama was not that popular in Israel because of the kind of criticism that you mentioned, and also a widespread perception in the Israeli public that Obama was favorable to Muslims. And Trump is doing what he has done throughout his own presidency, his entire presidency, which is playing to his base. His base likes this move, so does Netanyahu.
That's Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Top U.S. women diplomats speak out on sexual harassment. Lawmakers debate immigration measures as the U.S. government shutdown looms. U.S. Air Force unveils criminal reporting reforms in the wake of the Texas shooting. And Zimbabwean Business Forum is doubling its efforts to lure investors. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Authorities in California are calling on tens of thousands of people to flee their homes under a threat from wind-driven wildfires scouring communities northwest of Los Angeles. As many as five fires have closed highways, schools, and museums, shut down production of TV series, and cast a hazardous haze over the region. Here's Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti.
State resources are already here. They're part of our unified command. Those six fixed-wing aircraft that you see are the state. And we have folks on the ground, too. Obviously, they're stretched very thin. For instance, just on bulldozers right now, as part of operations commander, all our bulldozers are at Creek Fire. The counties are between, you know, there and up in Santa Clarita. So we're having to bring bulldozers in from other agencies further south just to help us with the fire line here.
Well, while the fire had just begun in Lakeview Terrace, Ventura County has been fighting a fire for days. And overnight, another one started near the Getty Center, one of the top museums in the United States. International Edition Sarah Williams spoke with VOA Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan.
The major fire, the largest, is burning in Ventura County and in the northwestern parts of Los Angeles County, along the coast and near the coast and a little bit inland. a huge fire up in Ventura, and, you know, well over 100 homes destroyed at this point. And the news today, as we, you know, in the early hours this morning, is that the Sepulveda Pass, which is an area, very busy area in Los Angeles, it separates two sections, the Los Angeles Basin and the San Fernando Valley, which is a suburban area. Some very expensive homes up in this pass, and the Getty Museum, which is a major art institution. There's a fast-moving fire, small, but apparently several homes set on fire, burned down in this area already. And that will be a major focus for firefighters because it's a heavily populated area.
Is it known at this point what has caused these fires?
Well, they know the general causes, and that is we've had year after year, at least 5 years of drought. Then we had, at least one winter of very heavy rains, which brought back the vegetation. And then we're back into our normal pattern of a very dry summer. We normally don't get any rain or very little rain in Southern California during the summer. So whatever vegetation is out there in the hills, which are close to some of the cities, dries out, and it becomes what the firefighters call fuel. And we had, as a result of the drought, then the heavy rains, then the normal drying in the winter months, we have a very heavy fuel load. And anything can set this off. And when it gets started, if you get warm temperatures, as we've had recently in Southern California, and gusty winds, the fires can just spread like crazy. And that's what we're seeing. And you know, anything, of course, could set them off. It could be arson. It could be an accident. It could be something they call ball lightning out in the desert. So you just don't know immediately. But once they get started, they're very hard to stop.
Well, in the area around Los Angeles where the fire is continuing, you were saying there's some expensive homes around there, but is it a heavily populated area?
Well, it's relatively heavily populated. They're very big single unit homes. I mean, they're mansions, many mansions up there, and other big nice homes. So they're not heavily populated in the sense of a lot of apartment blocks, but you have large lots, large homes, and a lot of them scattered all up through the hills. A lot of, you know, wealthy people, a lot of Hollywood people. Ronald Reagan had a home in this area, which was known as Bel Air when he was alive. And it's just there are a lot of people up there, and there are mandatory evacuations. The other thing is that it's a major thoroughfare for people commuting. And it's usually just packed with cars. And the northbound lanes, as we understand it, have been closed at this point. And, you know, this is just going to throw off the traffic patterns throughout L.A. These freeways are just jam-packed in the morning, and you just can't drive up through there right now.
That's VOA Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted on a resolution this week condemning the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya, a Muslim minority in Burma, also known as Myanmar. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the efforts to stop the crisis, including a tough sanctions bill cracking down on the Burmese military responsible for the violence.
Thousands displaced, raped, and murdered. Suffering described with one word by a U.S. lawmaker.
The word is genocide.
Encompassing a tragedy of enormous scope, as described by the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
600,000 Rohingya people driven from their homes in recent months, forced to cross the border into Bangladesh. Hundreds have been killed. At least 200 villages have been burned to the ground. Landmines have been placed inside Burma's border with Bangladesh, maiming refugees who are seeking safe haven. There are reports of rapes and all types of violence committed against the Rohingya.
A tragedy with an impact that reaches around the world.
This is a moral issue and a national security issue. No one is secure when extremism and instability is growing in this part of the world.
Efforts to address the crisis have strong bipartisan support. But Trump administration policies hindered efforts to help the estimated 600,000 refugees, said the head House Foreign Affairs Democrat.
This is more than 10 times the number of refugees the administration will allow into the United States this year. The same administration that ended America's participation in the UN effort to develop a global compact on migration. All this right in the middle of the world's most serious refugee crisis in history. So I say, shame on us, we should be doing more.
That next step, bills pending in the House and Senate that would impose harsh economic penalties on the Burmese military.
The United States certainly cannot solve every problem in the world, but there are some things that we can and that we must do. And imposing sanctions against the perpetrators of atrocities in Burma is one of the things that we must do.
And provide aid to refugees.
And the goal here is to get those that have been displaced and in general have gone to Bangladesh to allow them to return to Burma, return to their homes. Although a lot of those homes have been burned to the ground by the military. So there's an awful lot of economic development that's going to be necessary.
And while Congress is aware that help is urgently required,
there's so much need here, and this isn't something you can afford to wait a long period of time for.
With just a handful of working days left in 2017 and leadership occupied with working out a deal to fund the government, lawmakers likely won't vote on that bill until next year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we check in with Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, I know there's always something new and exciting happening in the world of social media. What's the latest?
Well, it is always exciting and ever-changing, Lori, and it's also fun. And social and digital media aren't just fun to use, but they're apparently also fun places to work. Kind of got a sense of that when you see all the perks that these companies offer to their employees. But this was confirmed today when Forbes and the career website Glassdoor.com released their list of best places to work 2018.
Oh, yeah?
It's based on reviews from employees submitted on this website, okay. Glassdoor.com. And coming in at number one, the one that's number one in all metrics for social media.
Facebook?
Facebook. Many employees
really?
Of Facebook, yeah, citing the perks like free food at work, high salaries, you know, those are obvious perks.
Think they can bring their dogs to work? Maybe?
I think they can. I think they get, you know, dry cleaning and all these great perks that they have. But it's not just all the fun perks. It's also flexible work scheduling, good work-life balance. Other employees saying on there that the company appreciates them not just as employees but as people. And they said that makes their job fun to do, and it makes them feel like they're serving a mission and appreciated by Facebook. So that's why Facebook comes in at number one, but you have a number of other big tech companies on the list. Number five is Google. LinkedIn, the social network for job seekers, is number 21. Number 39 is Microsoft. You have Yahoo at number 65. And Apple falling 48 spots to number 84.
Really?
I don't know what happened at Apple in the past year, but it's gone way down. But still making the top 100, so not a bad place to work by any stretch. But as I mentioned, these companies do offer a lot of perks. They do try to draw in a lot of talent and do so with high salaries. And so those are some of the big reasons why tech companies in particular have very happy employees. And that's why we see a lot of them on this list.
Good to know, and good for people out there looking for jobs. Maybe that's
if any of our listeners are looking for jobs, look for one of these tech companies.
Exactly.
If you have the computer skills,
and
you could do quite well for yourself.
And they have offices all over the world, so it's not like they have to be in the United States.
Yeah, 2 billion monthly active users, as I always say, on Facebook. So they do have offices really all around the world.
All right, Andrew, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, turning now to the latest in entertainment news, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. It's always good when we can talk about something fun and exciting and something that a lot of people are looking forward to, even if it's just from afar. And that's, of course, the royal wedding, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. And sounds like you might have some new details about the wedding.
Yeah, so they are getting married in May of 2018, and as they're kind of planning things and letting the world know some of their plans, we found out this week that Prince Harry has actually asked his big brother, Prince William, to be his best man at the wedding. It kind of breaks royal wedding protocol a little bit, because
really?
Traditionally, the groom has supporters. Prince Charles had his brothers, Andrew and Edward, serve as his supporters at his wedding, Princess Diana, in 1981. But when William got married, he decided to give Harry the distinction of a best man rather than a supporter. So Harry's doing that same thing. I think a supporter's kind of the same situation. It's somebody you're very close with, who's supporting you and your relationship. So that's very, very, very sweet that they're keeping that tradition.
Is it the same thing, or is it just a different name?
I think it is just a different name. They have adopted the best man title rather than a supporter. Supporter sounds a little stuffy. So
yeah, it does.
They're going to have fun with the wedding. They're a younger generation of royals. So it's definitely changing things.
Absolutely.
And William is really excited for Harry and Meghan. He was in Finland last week and actually told a reporter that, okay, yes, he's really happy for his brother, but also he's really happy because now maybe his brother will stop eating the food out of his refrigerator, which I thought was so funny. A prince steals food from
his own brother's refrigerator. They're just real people.
Right, exactly. It made them very human. That's such a little brother thing to do. So it's very exciting.
Absolutely. And, you know, here in the U.S., of course, we know, you know, there's been lots of talk lately about accusations of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and sounds like one pop star is really taking a step to prevent her daughter from being a victim.
So Pink had a funny conversation with her six-year-old daughter, which you wouldn't expect this from a six-year-old, but I guess her daughter Willow came home and said, "Mommy, how many boys can I have at once?" just after that. And so Pink said that once she collected herself and realized what her daughter was asking, told Willow, "Probably none of them. They don't deserve you. And if you do find one, they have to be kind and respectful. They have to be chivalrous. They have to be good to their moms, good looking, and funny," which I think is dating advice that pretty much everybody could take. I mean, if you're going to find the man or woman of your dreams, they need to have certain criteria. So she's teaching her daughter not to settle. And hopefully when Willow's ready to actually date, she'll heed her mom's advice.
I hope so, for sure. Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. Well, the eighth installment of the Star Wars saga, Star Wars The Last Jedi, opens in U.S. theaters this month. But as VOA's David Byrd tells us, the opening is bittersweet after the death of Carrie Fisher last December as Princess Leia to millions of fans.
We first met Princess Leia in 1977 when Carrie Fisher starred as the young but feisty leader of a rebel alliance battling the evil Galactic Empire. Fisher had finished all of her scenes for The Last Jedi before she died last December. Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, to Star Wars fans, says that he is still struggling with Fisher's death.
She was meant to be much more prominent in 9. But wait till you see her in the movie. She is just wonderful. We'll have to find a way to give her closure in 9, but we'll never be able to replace her, and there'll always be a hole in my heart because I loved her so much.
Writer-director Rian Johnson says that Fisher was first and foremost a writer, and some of her creative ad-libs made their way into the script.
And so my main memories of her are hanging out with her before the shoot and just like going through the script, and she would just throw out one-liners mostly and puns and jokes, and I would just scribble down all these like wordplay things she was throwing out and then maybe find a spot for one of them in the scene. But she was something else, man. She was really one of a kind.
John Boyega, who plays the stormtrooper-turned-rebel Finn, says that Fisher gives a nuanced performance in The Last Jedi.
It's a performance that requires a heartfelt approach, and I think she definitely had that. Now, I don't know how she had that while, you know, creating havoc on set with the jokes and the laughter. She just gets straight back into a zen and a seriousness that's required for this film. It's good to see them.
Director Rian Johnson says that it's up to director J.J. Abrams and writer Chris Terrio, who are working on the next Star Wars film, to decide what to do about Leia's character.
We had completely shot her part out and were in post-production already when she passed away, so we had a complete performance from her here. And I'm just, you know, however it gets handled in the future, I'm very thankful that we have this from her.
Mark Hamill says that recasting the character is out of the question. No one could replace Carrie Fisher as Leia.
Star Wars is about great triumphs, but great tragedies. And I can't think of a bigger tragedy than missing our Leia.
Star Wars The Last Jedi opens in U.S. theaters December 15th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 2 weeks between International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, observed on November 25th, and Human Rights Day, celebrated on December 10th, are dedicated to 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, 16 days of campaigning around the world to challenge and raise awareness of gender-based violence, and mobilizing people everywhere to bring about change. Gender-based violence is directed against individuals because of their actual or perceived biological sex or gender identity. It may be, and at times is, aimed at boys and men. But because most cultures confer lower social status on females, thereby creating an unequal power dynamic, women and girls are more likely than men and boys to be sexually or physically assaulted. Gender-based violence crosses every social and economic class, ethnicity, race, religion, and education level, and transcends international borders. It is perpetuated by the failure of governments and societies to recognize and value the human rights of women and girls, even though such discrimination causes harm to society as a whole. We know that violence against women and girls undermines global peace and security, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. It weakens the social fabric that binds families and communities together and prevents countries from achieving social stability and economic development. International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women and the accompanying 16 days of activism against gender-based violence are observed by the international community in order to shine a light on this scourge. We continue to recognize that violence against women remains a persistent threat and an obstacle to achieving women's equality. The United States is especially alarmed by violent extremist groups' use of violence against women as a tactic of terror to suppress women, recruit terrorists, and stigmatize communities. We denounce terrorist organizations' use of forced conscription, sexual exploitation, and abuse, including sex trafficking of women and girls, said Secretary of State Tillerson. The United States will never waver in its support for women's equality. In partnership with governments, international organizations, and civil society around the world, we will continue to work to end violence against women and girls globally and to ensure that women and girls have equal rights and opportunities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.